Okay, well, good afternoon. Let's get started. We're resuming from this morning's meeting of the Title Board. For the record, the time is 1:30 p.m. My name is Bill Hobbs, Deputy Secretary of State. With me is Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. At present, we do not have a representative from the Attorney General's office. As I indicated this morning, the last four agenda items that we originally scheduled, numbers 25 through 28, have been withdrawn. So the only agenda item for this afternoon is number 21. And I think we are ready to begin. So as a usual procedure, we'd like to hear from proponents first, see if the board has any questions about the measure, make sure we understand it, and find out what the proponents want to tell us about it. So, Mr. Gruskin, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Gruskin. I represent the proponents in this matter. This is a measure to implement the provisions of Article 29, also known as Amendment 41. They include a provision to assist in the funding of the Independent Ethics Commission provided by Article 29. They also provide for a clarification of certain provisions that I think the legislature has already clarified that are contained in Article 29. There are some slight revisions of some of those provisions, and then there are there's also a provision that makes it clear that this measure in essence readopts or reenacts provisions that might be struck from Article 29 between now and the time of the election. And when I say struck, I mean struck by the judiciary. That's where we are.
And the legislation you referred to, is that Senate Bill 210?
Yes, Senate Bill 210. Some of those provisions are by and large restated. Some of them are changed. When you get to the point of setting a title, we have some proposed changes to the title to reflect that.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Gruskin? Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the provisions in your Section 11, on your applicability clause.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain to me the last sentence and what that's intended to do?
Certainly. The last sentence actually is to be considered in tandem with the first sentence, which makes it clear that these are clarifying provisions. And therefore relate to the ability of the voters to look back and, in essence, make some revisions to the pertinent provisions without changing their substance. And the last sentence of Section 11 simply provides that if there is an adverse judicial decision as to Sections 1, 2, 3, 5, and 6 of Article 29, that it is the voters' intent to reenact those provisions. So rather than include them substantively, they are simply referred to as a matter of cross-reference.
So would it be fair to say that, in a sense, it's sort of reenactment by reference? You haven't included those provisions in this measure.
Right, that's correct.
And perhaps this is for later in the discussion, but do you think it would be just to have a statement talking about such a reenactment, do you think that that's sufficient notice to the voters? I mean, if they truly are reenacting these provisions, would that necessarily require more notice in a title similar perhaps to what was done the first time around with Amendment 41, to give them notice of what it is that they're reenacting?
I think that's obviously a matter for your discretion. It seems to me that courts have pretty universally held that you don't have to cross-reference every provision of law that's being affected by a measure. The voters have already seen this measure. They've already voted for this measure. They've already, I think one could probably fairly state that they've heard a great deal about this measure since its enactment. The fact that there are provisions relating to a prohibition on gifts to lobbyists and a cap on gifts to other government employees and officials is not something that I think would strike people as inordinately new or even problematic. However, if you think that it is helpful to provide certain cross-references, I think that's fine. I note that the staff draft did include the same introductory language that the ballot title for Amendment 41, which related to state constitutional provisions imposing standards of conduct by persons professionally involved with governmental activities. And so in that regard, it seems to me that there is certainly some reference, but if the board deems that not to be adequate reference, or you think it might be helpful for voters to get some specificity about the provisions that are being reenacted, I certainly don't have any problem. Just to break them down, Section 1 is of Article 29 is legislative findings. It seems to me that's probably not all that central. Section 2 is a series of definitions. Again, probably not all that critical. Section 3 has to do with the gift ban and the lobbyist and the $50 cap. Section 5 has to do with the Independent Ethics Commission, and Section 6 has to do with penalties. I guess if I were occupying that third seat and felt like it was necessary to include some reference to the specific provisions in Article 29, references to Sections 3 and 5 would probably be as thorough as I'd think it would.
In terms of the occupational tax in Section 10, could you explain a little in terms of your view of the connection of the tax, the connection with implementing Article 29?
There was some thorough debate in the General Assembly in this last session about whether or not the proposed fiscal note was in fact sufficient. Matter of fact, there was a time at which there was no legal advice being provided to the Commission. The concern about adequately funding the Commission is an ongoing concern, and the concern about taking those monies out of the general fund, as the general fund continues to get constrained by Tabor, will only become more pronounced. And therefore, without an adequate supervisory authority, as in the Independent Ethics Commission, basically the measure, no matter what it provides as the standards, cannot be effectively implemented. So what this occupational tax does is provide a source of revenue that the legislature may adjust as it deems appropriate to provide for that kind of revenue stream. It is strictly related to the Independent Ethics Commission. It cannot exceed 90% of the costs of the Ethics Commission, and therefore it is clearly overlapping, if you will, with the provisions that relate to the Ethics Commission's jurisdiction, which also go to how far and how thoroughly and how much authority it will need to use.
But does the measure require that the proceeds from this tax be expended for the Independent Ethics Commission?
There is a nexus in that, as I said before, the total amount of the tax can't exceed 90% of the cost of the commission. But the funds are actually placed in the general fund. And therefore, to the extent that they become part of the larger general fund, as all taxes do, they aren't traceable as if it were a special fund here in the Secretary's office.
So, in fact, proceeds from the tax could be spent on health care programs or prisons or other state expenses?
If one could trace a particular tax dollar, then I think you're right. I don't know that once it becomes part of a larger pool, that is possible. But in terms of a particular dollar, yes, it could be spent on any of a variety of state programs.
Thank you.
To follow up on that, the level of funding that the General Assembly provides the Independent Ethics Commission is still up to the General Assembly, isn't it?
That's correct.
So I thought I heard you saying something to the effect that that part of the nexus was to ensure adequate funding, and yet the General Assembly could still underfund it. Is that correct?
Yes, as a matter of legislative prerogative, subject, of course, to the provisions that are already in Article 29, which provide that the General Assembly shall provide adequate funding for the commission. So it seems to me that the General Assembly could fly in the face of that that mandate, but then it's probably opening itself up to suit. You know how the General Assembly doesn't like to get sued.
Any other questions for Mr. Gruskin? Let's go ahead and move on to the issue of single subject compliance. Mr. Gruskin, perhaps you could articulate for us, since we have to state the single subject in the titles anyway, what is your statement of the single subject of the measure?
This is a measure that implements the Independent Ethics Commission requirements in law. I would note for the board that we have kind of been up and down this path before. When the gun show loophole initiative was before this board, that was an issue of implementation that had both substantive provisions and it had fiscal provisions. That was challenged on single subject grounds, and the Supreme Court found that, in fact, implementation was an appropriate single subject, and that tying the two substantive provisions with the funding was an appropriate single subject. In addition, the 2004 measure relating to the tobacco tax also imposed a new tax and provided for substantive provisions relating to the administration of that tax. This was also challenged by certain opponents at the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in a one-line affirmance, rejected their challenges. So it seems to me there's ample precedent for taking this kind of a measure that has to do with even an existing set of governmental programs, adding funding and adding provisions that relate to the substantive conduct of those programs. I might note that in the case of the tobacco tax, the programs were not directly related to tobacco. They were simply related to the general issue of health, children's health programs, insurance programs, tobacco prevention programs, and the like. Therefore, and there were even funds set aside to keep states and counties whole for any diminution in their budgets. So clearly, there doesn't have to be a linear connection between the revenue and the way it's used. This, I think, is so obvious in terms of the connection between revenue, because professional lobbyists are regulated under Article 29 and are subject to the jurisdiction of the Independent Ethics Commission. Therefore, it seems to me that implementation issue, which is, as I say, been litigated for at least the last 9 years, all favorable to the issue of or to the side of the proponents, it's equally applicable here.
Mr. Gruskin, you made reference, and my memory's somewhat faulty after session burnout. You were talking about the initiative, was it the gun show?
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain a little bit more about what that particular initiative did and what the funding provisions were?
Certainly. That measure implemented or developed, it imposed certain requirements before a person could buy a firearm at a gun show. It defined certain terms and set up a manner in which, an administrative manner in which, approvals could be checked and obtained before there was a transfer of a firearm. And it imposed a fee, I believe it was a fee as opposed to a tax, for the funding of that particular program within, if I'm correct, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. So that was the nexus in that matter.
So the fee was actually paid by those applying to buy at the gun show and going through the background check and all
of
that?
Okay. Unlike the tobacco tax, where the beneficiaries of the tax revenue were not the payers of tax necessarily. I suppose someone could smoke and still be enrolled in one of the various health programs.
But under that initiative, it was specific in terms of sort of a laundry list of the proceeds from the increased tobacco tax shall be spent on these general categories of programs,
right,
with some default going to a general fund and all.
Right, right.
On that challenge to the Supreme Court, was single subject raised on that measure?
Yes, there were multiple law firms representing opponents, multiple opponents. Single subject was raised by all of them in different ways. I don't think that there was a conceivable single subject argument that was not raised by the law firms that represented the opponents. And I specifically recall, having represented the proponents, that the issue of the lack of connection between a revenue-generating mechanism and substantive programs was raised. I can also tell you that very issue was raised in challenges to Amendment 33, which was the racetrack video lottery terminal measure. I know that that was raised because I raised them, and the Supreme Court found my challenges to merit a one-line affirmance. So I can tell you fairly certainly, at least with regard to those two measures, that the Supreme Court did not look kindly upon the suggestion that a program was being funded by a revenue-raising mechanism, fee or tax.
Thank you.
I'm wondering how much it matters that the tax, the new tax in this measure, is on professional lobbyists. I mean, I'm starting from the premise, and you might want to correct me, is that although Article 29, to some degree, does relate to professional lobbyists, it's about a lot more. And so I'm wondering, first of all, about the how strong a connection that is to have the professional lobbyists provide a significant portion of the funding of the implementation through the Ethics Commission. But I'm also wondering why it matters. I mean, if the purpose is to raise revenue, to provide some additional revenue for the Ethics Commission, why does it matter who is taxed?
Well, I think you raise a very good point. You could increase the income tax or a sales tax or anything, and it would be every bit as much related as this one is. I don't know if it would be as related, but it would certainly be as legitimate. And I think the tobacco tax instance establishes that. Those programs had virtually nothing to do with anything but health. And that general category was found to be sufficient. And I think where the Supreme Court is, I mean, if I had to guess, that's all this is that they really don't care where the revenue comes from. I think the court's pretty much rejected three times now arguments that you have to have a specific link between the revenue-generating mechanism and the way it's spent. And I just don't think that it's a credible argument anymore. So I think your point is absolutely right. It almost doesn't make any difference which tax it is. In this instance, the amount generated by the tax is clearly not enough to cover the entire cost of the commission. Ultimately, that is a policy issue for the legislature. And you may be right that, that professional lobbyists aren't the focus of commission's work, in which case, if the legislature deems that to be so and the general fund to be in appropriate condition, it may reduce the tax. It may also find that professional lobbyists have cause to either ask for more advisory opinions or become either the complainants or the respondents in these matters, and it may increase the tax. Again, that's a legislative decision. But as to single subject, I don't think, I agree with you, I don't think it makes any difference.
Okay. This morning we had some discussion about several measures that created a new tax and then provided some purpose to which the new tax would be dedicated to, and opponents of those measures, that's number 13, 14, and 22, argued that there are cases, beginning with Public Rights and Water 2, that basically say you cannot create a new tax and in the same measure decide how those revenues will be dedicated. Now, this measure actually stops just short of saying how the new revenue will be dedicated, as Ms. Eubanks pointed out, but nevertheless, you've stated that that there is a connection. And I'm kind of wondering, I mean, I'm not sure there's a question here because you didn't have the benefit of that discussion this morning, but at least there is a point of view that you can't do both in one measure. And I'll mention one of the cases, although it's, I don't know how compelling it is, in addition to Public Rights and Water, too, which is more general. I think it was number 84 and number 85, which was tax cuts, where the court held that there were multiple subjects because the measure not only reduced revenue, but also required reductions in expenditures. And the argument this morning was a measure arguably like this, or the ones that we had this morning, are kind of the inverse of that, where you increase revenue and you increase, you know, a purpose for which that revenue would be dedicated. At least there is some difference of opinion maybe about where the jurisprudence is on that.
I'm curious, how did the board rule this morning?
We approved the measures for single subject.
I will tell you that I cited every one of those cases when I was opposing Amendment 33, and I don't know if it gave the court a good laugh or whether they paid no attention to it, but I think in terms of, I don't think that you can hold those cases up to a mirror and say, well, the reverse is true as well, because in the question, the fundamental question in terms of 84 and 85 was whether or not voters would understand that by cutting taxes, they were necessarily also cutting programs. That it was, in essence, a concealed effect, and that it's kind of the old Christmas tree aspect of single subject analysis. When there are more things for the, when there are so many things for the voters to balance, it's not fair to ask them to make a decision that A is better than B. That's not what's at issue here. When you are creating a funding mechanism to ensure that a program either is developed or is effectively implemented, you're not asking voters to weigh A versus B. So I think there's a distinction there.
Could I ask you to comment on number 55? I think that's one. That's the most recent from last year, the immigration measure, that I think the most recent decision from the Supreme Court. And I think the board needs to figure out, you know, what principles are there for us to apply in future cases. And so I'm wondering if you have any comment about how that may or may not guide us in this situation as far as single subject analysis.
Well, the difference between this measure and 55 is that 55, by its wording and by its by the proponents' advocacy of it, said that it dealt with every program in state government, no matter what. And the court looked at that and was concerned about the fact that voters wouldn't understand that no matter what category. 21 doesn't even come close to that. 21 deals, I mean, it, as you point out, you could have an unrelated tax to fund a program. 21 has a related tax to fund a related program. And so I think if there are concerns about how the 55 decision will be applied prospectively, they're probably not, they ought not be major concerns here. This one is crafted in a very different way, and the proponents don't suggest that it will have kind of the overarching effect that 55 had.
I am troubled by the tax and the single subject question. As far as traditional single subject analysis, one of the things I'm asking myself is, and you alluded to one of the tests, I think, is there, is this a surprising thing that would surprise voters if they knew that in a measure to implement Amendment 41, Article 29, that there was a tax on lobbyists? And I don't know. I guess I'm wondering about that, and I'm also wondering about log rolling as well. Frankly, I'll just say it out loud, is that a tax on lobbyists, unless there really is a necessary connection, might be a popular thing to do, for all I know. But I'm wondering about. I mean, it sort of comes down ultimately to the basic question of how closely related is this to the purpose of the measure. And I'm struggling with that. But under either of those tests, that there may be surprise or there may be log rolling going on, it seems like there's at least the possibility that the tax could qualify under those principles. But I know you disagree, but maybe you'd like to help me through that.
Well, it seems to me it wasn't the choice of the proponents how Article 29 was originally structured. The fact that it has one identifiable class of people who I think are in fact in a position, either they or their principals, to use the lion's share of services provided by the commission was not something that we structured. But I'm struck by the comment you made a few minutes ago, which is we could have chosen any tax. It didn't have to be related. So why not increase the tobacco tax to fund the Ethics Commission? Because we know that that's politically popular. So if you can do that, then it seems to me that that necessarily log rolling doesn't come into play. If it did, then you couldn't use any tax. You'd only have to use a related tax that didn't create some sort of undue partisan advantage, political advantage. This is an instance in which you can take judicial notice of the fact that there are more demands on the general fund than the general fund can meet. There is a new substantive program that is the Ethics Commission, for which a mandate was placed in the Constitution that it be funded without any sort of funding mechanism. It's deja vu all over again. And so to the extent that this measure addresses that without undermining the substance of either what the voters did in November or what the General Assembly did this last session, it seems to me all necessarily related. Is a tax on lobbyists going to be popular? Well, I don't know. I don't have any polls. We haven't conducted any surveys or focus groups to think that a tax on lobbyists who use the commission is any more popular than a tax on tobacco or a tax on liquor or a tax on gasoline. We have no way of knowing that. But even if it were, the fact, as you pointed out earlier, that it could be any tax fund the program means that I think we're on solid ground here.
Well, probably more to the center of the question for me is is what is the purpose of the occupation tax? And I'm having a little trouble with what I understand you have said so far, in that yes, there is a requirement. The General Assembly must adequately fund the Independent Ethics Commission. That's probably not unusual. There's a lot of things that the General Assembly has to fund that don't have separate taxes. And in this case, so far as I know, they did adequately fund it. There is a bill that made an appropriation, in which I think, based on the OSPB fiscal estimate for this measure, I mean, this measure may raise less than $30,000, but the ongoing costs of the Ethics Commission, I think, are 130-some thousand. So it's hard for me to make the connection that this particular part of the measure, you know, has a necessary and proper connection to the main purpose. In fact, that's part A of my question, but part B is would it be a separate and distinct purpose to qualify the measure for the ballot this year? Is that the purpose of a tax or a kind of Tabor question to get the measure on the ballot earlier than it otherwise would be on the ballot?
Well, let me answer the second part first, which is that if the commission is not appropriately funded from an early point in its tenure, then creating a funding mechanism sometime down the road, after which it has already lost public credibility, will be too late. So the goal is to get the funding mechanism put in place as soon as possible, to preserve the capacity of the commission, to preserve the credibility of the commission, and to provide, frankly, the General Assembly with options that it may utilize as soon as the 2008 session. I think I've forgotten the first part of your question, which is always the danger in answering.
The first part was just a little broader. This seems unnecessary for the major purpose of implementation of Article 29, because presumably the appropriation that's already made is adequate for the Independent Ethics Commission, and this is such a tiny amount of money. It's hard for me to see that this has a necessary connection to the major purpose of the measure.
Well, that was the reason. Rather than impose a tax constitutionally that could not be adjusted even in the first year, that was the reason it was set at a modest level, with the understanding that the General Assembly could adjust it upwards to provide for adequate funding. Nobody sitting here knows how burdened the Ethics Commission is going to be with complaints, with requests for advisory opinions, and under Senate Bill 210, requests for private letter rulings. Any person can request a private letter ruling. Any person who is subject to Article 29 can request an advisory opinion. According to the rhetoric over the last several months, that's tens of thousands of people. I think this has maybe one or two staff people assigned to it. If there are, in fact, the many requests for assistance, forget complaints and hearings, for a minute, then clearly $132,000 isn't going to be enough. Not to mention the fact that this measure provides for district court review. There will be some additional fiscal impact related to this measure. So the need for additional funding is greater now than if 21 were to pass, than it was when 41 passed.
Well, I guess it seems to me there's maybe two purposes for the occupation tax that I think I'm hearing, but clarify for me if you would. One is that by providing additional revenue and exempting it from the Tabor limitations, you induce the General Assembly to provide adequate funding, because it takes that out of competition for other general fund dollars under the Byrd-Arbuckle limitations. So it doesn't entirely eliminate the competition, but I think, mostly does, at least to the 90% level. That would be one purpose. The other purpose would be that I thought I heard you say is that it also would help address a deliberate underfunding by the General Assembly, perhaps because of, you didn't say this, but perhaps because of legislative hostility towards Article 29. But it doesn't look like the second, at least, would be achieved by this, since the General Assembly could still choose to underfund the commission. This wouldn't prevent that.
No, and I didn't mean to imply. I don't remember what I said that would have implied that the legislature trying to purposely underfund.
And you didn't.
I don't ascribe that motive to the General Assembly, and don't anticipate that they would. But I mean, the reality of the competing budgetary demands is strong enough that $132,000 for the Ethics Commission came out of somebody else's budget. It did. It may have come out of your budget for all I know. But the truth is, it was $132,000 out of an already strapped budget. And the very real possibility that the workload may exceed what the budget analyst anticipated is great. We know that there are people, that there are many people who have raised questions about how Article 29 applies. So would it be unreasonable to think that those people will be sending requests for advisory opinions to the commission? Not at all. With its current staff, is it reasonable to think that the commission can handle all those requests? No, I don't think so. Not to mention the fact that you know, at this point, without a commission, we don't know what the hearing backlog will become. But clearly, it is a voluntary commission. They don't yet have budgetary authority to have an assistant AG assigned to them. If they're going to have hearings that comply with due process, at some point they're going to have to go to the General Assembly for funding. And this provides for the flexibility to get that adequate funding.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Grootkin? Okay. Thank you. So continuing on with the question of single subject compliance, I have one other person signed up. Mr. Gessler, do you want to address single subject compliance?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Why don't you come forward and introduce yourself and tell us who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs and Ms. Eubanks. My name is Scott Gessler. I represent the First Amendment Council, and we do oppose this provision on single subject grounds. And I think the board has identified some of the issues. I'll speak briefly on them. First of all, this provision contains very clearly several separate subjects. The standard for a single subject is something that there are several standards, as the board knows full well. But it can't hide purposes that are unrelated to the main subject. The purposes have to have a logical connection to one another or be necessarily dependent upon one another.
If I may interrupt you just for a moment, Mr. Dunn is joining us. The time is 2:08 p.m., and he is the representative of the Attorney General's office. And I don't know whether he's lost the benefit of where we are, Mr. Dunn, as we're into the single subject analysis of number 21. We've asked Mr. Grootkin a number of questions about it, and we just started hearing from Mr. Gessler. So,
my apologies for being late. I was doing the Attorney General's work elsewhere.
My train of thought on the single subject standards was somehow interrupted. But basically, incongruous subjects that are not connected to one another, subjects that are hidden within the folds of others. And I think we have all of these problems here. Mr. Grootkin stated, and has stated earlier as well, the subject of this matter is that it implements the Independent Ethics Commission. With respect to the occupational tax, does not implement the Ethics Commission. Logically, it simply doesn't. It is not, the funds from the occupational tax are not required to fund the Ethics Commission. The funds from the occupational tax are not required to do anything in particular. It is simply a general tax placed upon a certain segment of the population, approximately 600 people, that may or may not be used for the Ethics Commission. Now, certainly the proponents would like it to be used for the Ethics Commission. Certainly the proponents hope that it will reduce the burdens of funding the Ethics Commission. And those may all well be admirable desires, but it is not contained within the text of the measure. Simply limiting the occupational tax based on the Ethics Commission needs, however those may or may not be determined, or funding levels, does not create the necessary connection. The implementation of the Ethics Commission, I would submit, well, certainly based on the text of the measure, will be the exact same with or without the occupational tax. It's simply not connected. It's simply not necessary for this particular measure. It is a separate subject, and that subject is to raise general revenues that may or may never be used for the Ethics Commission. There's absolutely no connection there. And I would also submit that if this is treated as a single subject, essentially what the board is proposing is a principle whereby any subject matter, one can add a tax to any subject matter by simply saying that it should be used, we hope it will be used, to implement that subject matter. Although there are no requirements that it do so, no necessity that it does so, no logical connection within the text of the measure itself, no necessary dependence. And for that reason, this board should reject this effort. You simply should not be able to, well, you cannot, under the same subject, add a generalized tax to the general revenue, and say that we hope it will be used for something verbally, not even in the text, without requiring it that tax be used for the specific purpose that connects the other areas of the text. And we'd also submit that another unstated purpose here is to enable this provision to go on the 2007 ballot, because odd year elections, the only types of initiatives that are allowed during the odd-year coordinated election is our tax, well, as interpreted by the Secretary, our tax increases. And what you've also heard is substantial concern about the need to move quickly implement the Ethics Commission before it loses credibility, things along those lines. So another purpose is to move quickly and to allow the implementing measures, the definitional measures, the mechanics of the Ethics Commission to be implemented sooner rather than later in the 07. And the only way to do that in 07 is to add a tax to it. The detailed procedures that this contains are unrelated to the tax. The other subject, radically separate subject, is the readoption of earlier provisions.
Mr. Gessler, can I interrupt you for a second? I should disclose first, Mr. Gessler and I used to practice in the same law firm. Occasionally socialize, but in fact, I didn't even know he was going to be here, but in no way affects my analysis here. If the tax, what if the Ethics Commission funding was directly limited to the amount raised through the tax? Would that be a sufficient nexus?
I'd argue probably not. I think that in order for this to meet the single subject of implementation, and again, this is implementation here, of the Ethics Commission, the tax has to be used for implementation. And that is the connection. We're implementing something here. And so if the tax is not even used to implement the Ethics Commission, I don't think that's a necessary nexus. It has to be more. Now, there may be some hypothetical situations where simply a ballot initiative could say there shall be a $50 occupational tax on lobbyists, and the Ethics Commission shall not be funded at a level greater than that commission, that tax. And that's all there were. Perhaps in that case it may be a single subject. But in this case there is far more than that. And there are substantial details of implementation that are necessary for the implementation here. And the tax is not part of that. It's simply not part of that. So perhaps in some hypothetical instance situation could occur, but certainly not in this one here. And again, it's not part of the actual language before the board.
Can I, now that we've sort of interrupted you, but I have a related question, I think. What about the argument that a purpose of the tax, when read, in particularly given that subsection 4 of section 10 says that the revenue raised is exempt from any restrictions on appropriations, what about the argument that we heard earlier that the General Assembly then, that revenue is not subject to the general fund appropriation limit, and therefore the General Assembly can appropriate this money for the Ethics Commission without having to take the money, the general fund appropriations, from somebody else?
My argument goes back to the earlier one. That is something that would apply to any tax connected to any measure ever. It's an exception it's a principle that effectively swallows the rule here. There is no limiting construction to that type of argument. If the implementation simply is, well, it gives the General Assembly more money so that if they want, they can use that more money for this particular substantive provision. If that's the standard, there can never be a separate subject from a tax and a particular substantive measure. And we would certainly reject that if the single subject is intended to ensure that there is a logical connection or a dependency between the different provisions, and here we don't have that. The General Assembly, of course, can always do whatever it wants with any level of funding. And in this instance, the General Assembly can do whatever it wants with any of these funds that it receives from the occupational tax. There's simply no connection to the Ethics Commission with respect to the use of that tax. It does not implement the Ethics Commission. We may want it to implement the Ethics Commission. Hope it does. We may urge the General Assembly in separate proceedings or petitions to use it to fund the General Assembly, but in this measure, I'm sorry, fund the Ethics Commission, but in this measure, it does not do so. It is not connected in this measure. The other issue is the readoption of other provisions in the event that a court strikes them down. That's a separate purpose. That is not implementation of the Ethics Commission. What it is, it's re-implementation of an earlier provision here. That is certainly something that the voters looking at this, if they say, I'm taxing lobbyists, perhaps I would submit that voters are quite happy to tax lobbyists, and it would be wildly popular, especially since there are only 600 lobbyists to vote against it. A voter would say, well, I'm taxing lobbyists and I'm implementing the Ethics Commission. A voter would not know that there's also a pending court proceeding, or that there could be a pending court proceeding, would not know based on that, because it's not connected, that they are essentially readopting or reenacting provisions of another measure, which are not contained even in the face of this, in the event that any court action is successful. That is a fundamentally separate purpose. That purpose is, again, not necessary, not connected to implementing the Ethics Commission. Now, one can argue that as long as I use the term Ethics Commission and have something to do with ethics and have something to do with the commission here, that it falls under the same subject. But I think the Supreme Court has soundly rejected that, for example, in the judicial qualifications. In several cases, which were discussed in the judicial qualification case recently, that simply labeling a broad category a subject is not adequate to meet single subject requirements. There does have to be some connection within the text, and it does have to fall within the same purpose. So at a minimum, the separate tax has a separate purpose. That's to fund the state of Colorado's general operations. That is the purpose of it. And there's also a purpose in here of readopting earlier provision in the event that there is a successful court challenge to it. So for all of those reasons, well, those in particular, this has at a minimum three subjects, and we can discuss as well whether or not the various definitional matters and the appointment procedures and things like that are separate subjects, but at a minimum, those are three separate subjects that this matter has. Ben?
I hope I'm not treading old ground here that you guys already covered. And Mr. Gruskin's question is for you as well. If Amendment 41 itself was multi-subject, would this Section 11, the reenactment of the Sections 1 through 6, necessarily be multi-subject?
Yes, it would be. Absolutely.
Why?
Because you are enacting, in and of themselves, separate subject matters. If a statute or a measure has multiple subjects, and I enact that measure, I'm enacting multiple subjects. If I reenact that measure, I'm reenacting multiple subjects as well. So it is a multiple subject issue. I haven't gone into that details. If there's any motion to consider, I certainly may. But I would also note that my understanding is that the underlying action here was not taken to the Colorado Supreme Court, so there wasn't a decision. But yeah, to the extent that the underlying sections are separate subjects, this it adds yet more subjects to this.
Any other questions, Mr. Dunn?
Again, for both you guys, a subject that may have already come up. I've been waiting, 6 months to ask this question. How does this fit, and particularly the tax, fit with the Initiative 55 opinion last year?
The
immigration opinion. To put you on the spot, I don't know if you read it recently, but
just ironically, I happened to get up to the podium, and I think Mr. Gruskin did address it as well. The Initiative 55, I think the decision is a challenging one to apply in general. But under those principles here, what it did say is that if you have a general subject, okay, for example, in the immigration issue, it was all governmental services. And that case said, well, all governmental services, that's not a single purpose. That's not a single subject. And the reason why it's not a single subject is because there are means to an end, and therefore all government services is actually multiple purposes, multiple purposes of many, many services here. And then the court went on to sort of dissect exactly what that meant and found two separate subjects. And specifically, I would cite to the slip opinion, page 19 on that. Arguments here by providing a generalized tax, which can be used for all services, and connecting it to the implementation of the Ethics Commission, I think it simply reinforces the fact that those are two separate.
Wasn't the, and I have to confess I haven't read it in a little while, but the Initiative 55 opinion. It wasn't so much that just the different services were different subjects, wasn't it that the, I'm probably going to get myself in trouble trying to remember what it said, but that the saving of money was one subject and the reduction in services was another subject?
I think that's correct. That's correct. And I think what it does is it shows skepticism on the behalf of the court towards initiative proponents who seek to aggregate multiple purposes within a single matter, in large part because it's a way to protect the electorate from log rolling, and it's a way to protect the electorate from drafting that cunningly connects different things together. So I think the way to read that as well is it's a general attitudinal approach by the Supreme Court to protect the initiative process, and I think it's one that's necessary here as well, a skepticism, particularly because we have such disparate subjects in this particular case. Frankly, I think the immigration case is very difficult to meaningfully apply.
I agree.
Any other questions for Mr. Gerstner? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gruskin, if you'd like to respond, plus since Mr. Dunn wasn't here, didn't have the benefit of some of your comments, if there's sort of encourage you to, if you want to restate anything, I don't.
Whatever you think the right answer is. Mr. Gessler suggested that there's no requirement that the tax funds be spent on the Ethics Commission. And I think it relates to Mr. Hobbs' point that a specific tax dollar could find its way to the general fund, and then if you could actually track it, that dollar might be spent on health care or something else. Section 10 is very clear. Paragraph 1 says, draws that nexus. In order to supplement the state's general fund for revenues expended on the Independent Ethics Commission, the purpose of the tax is specifically related to the expenditures on the Ethics Commission. And then the tax is set at such a level that it will come, it can come close to, but not exceed, the cost of the commission. It isn't just kind of this willy-nilly tax that the revenue of which, once it's put in the general fund, could end up any place. If the analysis suggested to you just a little bit earlier was accurate, then any new tax could not survive scrutiny unless it was put in a special fund in the Treasurer's office, and that fund was used to fund a particular program. As soon as you put money into the big pot, it necessarily could get spent in any one of a number of ways. And that simply has nothing to do with the single subject analysis. The question is whether or not people know what they're voting on and they feel like they're voting on one basic issue. it was also suggested to you that the reenactment of Article 29 is problematic. But if you take a look at, in answer to your question, in terms of if 41 was a multi-subject measure, is this a multi-subject measure? I don't think it's as easy a question as Mr. Gessler thought. The question is, what is the second subject? And the only provisions that are reenacted here are the purpose, definitions, the gift ban, and lobbyist prohibition. The Ethics Commission, Section 6,
the penalty,
which related to penalties. It's got nothing to do with the provisions relating to, for instance, the revolving door, which may or may not be a separate subject. I don't know, but it's not related to this measure.
Well, can I ask a question? What, does anyone have Amendment 41? What section is that? I thought this was everything. Isn't it 1 through?
Section 4 is.
Oh, that's the one missing. Okay.
Revolving door.
Okay.
And in addition to that, Section 9, which is the, has prompted so much fascinating legal comment on whether it's possible in terms of facilitating legislation, conflicting provisions declared inapplicable, and the references to cities and counties. All those are not included. So the question is, does a measure with a legislative declaration, relevant definitions, a gift ban, a commission to adjudicate that gift ban, and penalties related to the gift ban, is that one subject? And I would suggest to you that it is. And therefore, if one of these other sections is deemed to be a provision that exceeds the single subject of this measure, that's pretty much irrelevant. And as you know, Mr. Dunn, plaintiffs didn't even see fit to bring this as part of their preliminary injunction. So we're not going to have resolution of that issue for years. So you have to use the presumption that this body, when it set the title for Amendment 41, did so with recognition of the statutes and the Constitution, did so in furtherance of its objective, and set it as a single subject. That issue was never even challenged. And so the presumption has to be that you did your jobs right. As to the applicability of number 55, I've given the other board members my own recitation on this. Again, I'm not quite as clear about things, Mr. Gessler, but then that's the nature of life. I don't see 55 as being a big obstacle. Take a look at what the court said in terms of 55. It specifically pointed to the statements of the proponents, websites, and everything else, where they said this applies to every program there is at every level of government. And I think what the court said is, if you're dealing with administrative programs, that's administrative costs, that's one thing. But if you're dealing with substantive programs that are going to take away substantive entitlements or rights or change the substantive obligations of government, that's a different thing. And people ought to know that they're voting on both. This is got to do with the Ethics Commission. It's a tax that relates to the people who are regulated by the Ethics Commission. And therefore, it seems to me not to have 55 problems. And I agree there will be lots of litigation trying to determine exactly the parameters of number 55. But I think if you look at its four corners, it said that when there is a proposal to change everything that government does, big and small, and the proponents, in fact, use that as a basis for advocating it, then you're necessarily going to have people who are confused. This doesn't do that.
Are there other examples of initiatives that the title board has adopted? Did you already go through this?
No, I did, but I forgot to do it again because I was going to, in light of the comments that were made. If you take a look at, for instance, number 33 was video lottery terminals at the racetracks. And it both imposed fees and set up a new way to divide all the resulting funds, as well as substantively expanded the lottery to include racetracks and casinos for these devices, as well as to set up the ceilings, if you will, the number of devices and the registration or licensing process and how often and where the facilities were going to be. So that's a substantive requirement coupled with a revenue-raising change. That didn't...
Where did that fee go? Was that general fund?
The fee went... Well, you have two different fiscal impacts. There was a $500 per device fee that went into one of the funds. And then you had a change in the allocation of lottery funds from this new source. So you actually had two different revenue streams created by this measure. And neither one of them went into the general fund. They either went into the promotion fund, they went into the lottery fund, and then they created a new spigot to provide. Mr. Hobbs probably remembers this better than I do. But there was some money for parks, and there was some money for tourism promotion as a result of that.
So none of it actually went to regulating lotteries or video terminals? Or it didn't go to the...
There was a one-time license fee of $500 per device. Machine. So presumably in the licensing process, that was used to defray costs for the approval process.
And then that was approved by the board. Was that challenged?
Yes. By yours truly, the court gave me a one-line affirmance of the board's decision that there was no single subject problem.
Was it challenged as those being separate subject?
There were challenges as to the revenue and the substantive programs being separate subjects, as well as several other challenges, both as to single subject and the accuracy of the title. So thanks for reminding me of that one, because I would have. I think that answers Mr. Kessler's main points and Mr. Dunn's outstanding questions. I'm happy to answer anything else that might have come up.
Thank you.
Sure.
I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the single subject issue? If not, then I'll turn to board discussion. Any discussion by the board on the question of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement?
Huh? I'll start us.
Okay. Ms. Eubanks.
I don't always have to be first. This one is a tough one because it's structured differently than most of the types of initiatives that come before us with a funding source and what those funds may be used for, as well as then other related provisions. If Mr. Grushin had been here this morning, he would have heard my comments in vigorously defending the right of proponents to provide a source of funding and then to dictate what purposes that source of funding is used for. There was an argument that basically you could only do one or the other in a measure or else you violate single subject, and I don't believe that's the case. This situation is a little different. Rather than providing a revenue source and then dictating what it can be used for, it provides a revenue source, and although certain components of the tax are related in terms of being imposed on lobbyists and is intended to supplement the expenditure of general fund monies currently expended for the Independent Ethics Commission under Article 29, it's different in the sense that it doesn't really dictate the use of the proceeds. It goes to the general fund, I understand that and appreciate that explanation from Mr. Grushin. To me, I think I disagree with Mr. Gessler. Is I'm not sure that I see the potential of three subjects here. I think that you see, what I see is the measure provisions dealing with standards of conduct, including sort of the new provisions included specifically in the measure as well as sort of the reenactment issue. I still think that those provisions relate to standards of conduct, and so I would view those all as one, and I'm very comfortable in terms of taking the position that those provisions, although somewhat varied, the revolving door provision, all the different things as a single subject, because I was on the title board last time when we set the title for 41, and I was comfortable then and I'm comfortable now that all of those provisions deal with standards of conduct. So in my mind, the issue becomes, can we put the tax in with that subject of standards of conduct? And first, I want to say, because it's come up twice in the discussion, that the possible underlying purpose of including a tax in this measure or any measure as to whether it could qualify for one particular election or not, I don't believe is a relevant discussion for this board. I don't think it has anything to do with a determination of single subject. I think that's a side issue. And the fact that someone may or may not do that as a, you know, a strategy or whatever purpose they're trying to accomplish, I don't think that's relevant for single subject discussion.
Actually, to interrupt, there's actually case law. I researched that question.
Yeah, and
case law saying that.
Yeah, and so I'm just not even comfortable going on that argument. I think that we look at it as a purely single subject determination. I don't find the court's decision on number 55 very helpful. I don't know if I'll ever find it very helpful. I think we've heard both this morning and this afternoon people saying, I don't know how you make sense of it in light of the other decisions issued by the court on single subject. What I do find probably more helpful in terms of this particular measure are some of the other cases, the public rights in Water 2. There's also one that was INRI proposed initiative 99-2000, number 200A, which is 992 P. Second 27. And in those decisions, when the court's talking about the single subject requirement, and especially in the public rights in water, too, it talks about even when provisions share a common characteristic, they do not satisfy single subject requirement when they do not have a uniform or common objective. And where two provisions merely have a common characteristic, such as a connection, such a connection is too broad and too general to make them part of the same subject. And while I agree with Mr. Gruskin's comments as well as Mr. Hoff's comments that I don't think that the fact that the tax is imposed on a lobbyist, I agree. I mean, you could have it being income tax, you could be severance tax, I don't care what the source of the revenue is. The fact that it just happens to be imposed on a profession that is subject to some of the standards of conduct imposed by Article 29, that's a coincidence, but probably nothing more than that, at least in terms of my analysis of single subject. The fact that the rate of the tax cannot generate more revenue than 90% of the expenses of the Independent Ethics Commission is, again, a coincidence, but I don't know that that necessarily makes a connection for me one way or the other. To me, the ultimate deciding factor is the proceeds and what the purpose of the proceeds is. And because the language in the measure on that on the tax provision is very interesting and somewhat unusual in terms of using the language about supplementing the general fund, of course, I pull out my dictionary and just to get a better idea of this idea of supplementing. And the definition of supplement is something added to complete a thing, make up for a deficiency, or extend or strengthen the whole. And while you can say, and I think Mr. Gruskin was making this argument, that this is providing revenue that can be utilized for the expenses of the commission, if that's what the General Assembly desires, that it's making up for any general fund expenditures that the General Assembly may make to comply with the funding requirement of Article 29. But the fact that the measure doesn't require these monies to be used for that purpose, that's where I lose the connection. It's sort of this general, it's under a general subject of the standards of conduct, but I don't think that you have the connection of the revenues to the enforcement, to the implementation of the standards of conduct. And that's where I lose the connection and feel that that's where this measure fails in terms of single subject, because that money could be used for any purpose, and there's no guarantee that it's going to be used for this purpose. Whether voters are given that impression, depending on what the title may be, I don't know. But although the monies are made available in case the General Assembly wants to take advantage of them and use them for that purpose, they could use it completely for something else. And that's where I lose the connection for single subject purposes. And so I think at this point I'd be inclined to find that the measure doesn't contain a single subject. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If it was specifically allocated then to a Independent Ethics Commission fund, would that meet your analysis?
I don't even know. I agree with Mr. Gruskin in terms of, you know, once you dump money into the general fund, it's all blended and it's very hard to track, although there are specific accounts within the general fund. There's what people call special funds or cash funds. I think just to say that the monies shall be used for the commission, I mean, the whole concept that 210 funded the Ethics Commission out of the general fund, the original provisions of Article 29 don't require the funding of the commission from the general fund or anything. I mean, it was silent. It just said you have this funding obligation to fund the commission. And so I think the measure could have set up a special fund, or just to require the monies to be used for the commission, to me, would have established that connection between providing the funding and the standards of conduct in terms of using those monies to enforce the standards of conduct through the commission. But that all of a sudden I'm going along the road and all of a sudden I hit this pothole that I lose that connection because of the fact that it's just the monies, it generates monies, but it doesn't say that it's used for this purpose. And although the underlying intent, it makes monies available that the General Assembly could utilize for this purpose, there's nothing in the measure to make that connection, to me.
Does it bring it closer when you have the other provision within Article 29 requiring the funding? Well, I guess, no, that'd be in... That's in Senate Bill 210, right?
Well, no, the provision of funding, that's actually in the existing provision on the commission
section
in Section 5, yeah. It says the General Assembly shall appropriate reasonable and necessary funds to cover staff and administrative expenses to allow the commission to carry out its duties pursuant to this article. In terms of saying that this particular tax falls under the subject, in my mind, of standards of conduct. In my mind, it just doesn't get there. It falls short because I can't make that connection between the proceeds being used for that purpose. And while I know we've dealt with this issue many times, sort of, this provision to me is sort of backwards of most of the provisions that we see. Usually, like this morning, and Mr. Dunn wasn't here for that discussion, but on previous measures dealing with severance tax, you know, many times you have an initiative that establishes a revenue source and then says what that revenue source is to be used. Well, here you already have sort of these standards of conduct established in the Constitution, and now this measure clarifying and expanding some of those provisions, and now providing a revenue source, but the revenue source doesn't have to be used for the standards of conduct. And so I see it being different than most of the ones we see, where their purpose is to dictate the use of the monies. This one doesn't go quite that far. Now, how, you know, what would be sufficient to make that connection, whether it's a special fund designation, whether it's just a requirement that the monies be used, I don't know. But something like that, I think, would at least help me make that connection. To me, it just sort of, I run into the wall because I can't get there from the proceeds knowing that it is definitely connected to the standards of conduct.
Yeah, even though, I mean, I think when read in combination with Section 5, it says you must pour some money into the bucket and some money must be taken out of the bucket for the commission. But your analysis is that unless you can follow that dollar directly?
Well, and perhaps the General Assembly would do that. They could, I mean, because, like I say, it's sort of, you know, is it first in, first out, you know, all those different accounting principles, you know, that in terms of the amount of money spent, obviously, perhaps because of the result of this measure, the pot of money has gotten bigger. But does that necessarily mean that the General Assembly, one, is going to expend any more money on the commission, or that this source of revenue is being used to fund the commission? I mean, it could be spent on anything. It could be used for judges. It could be used for any general governmental purpose that's funded out of the general fund. And the fact that it expands the pot may make things easier from a appropriation point of view, but I don't know that in my mind the connection is there that as a result of this measure and this tax that the funding for the commission is insured any more than what it currently is. I mean, obviously the General Assembly funded the commission at whatever level they thought was appropriate, and whether that grows over time, whatever, and understanding the characteristics, the battles that go on in terms of balancing the budget and the competing needs and all of those. But the fact that you have a tax here that's adding to the pot, in my mind, it doesn't make that last connection to that the tax is for enforcement of the standards of conduct imposed by Article 29. But if you guys convince me otherwise, I mean, you know, help me make that connection. But that's sort of where I am right now in terms of that gap.
I am actually still torn. I haven't made up my mind. I've been going back and forth because I think this is a hard one. You know, the best statement of a connected purpose is the measure itself, saying it's to supplement the general fund for revenues expended on the ethics commissions, et cetera. Now, that's a connection. It's offsetting those expenses. It's just such a weak connection. And as if I understand the discussion correctly, it's really weak because since Section 5 already requires, constitutionally requires, the General Assembly to appropriate reasonable and necessary funds for those expenses, then what does this add to that? And it seems to me the discussion was to the effect that mostly this doesn't further Article 29, rather it addresses those agencies whose budgets might otherwise be reduced because of having to fund the Ethics Commission. I mean, that seems to be almost almost the primary benefit, since the Ethics Commission already has to be adequately funded. Then offsetting that simply replaces that revenue for the benefit of other state agencies. Now, maybe I'm misunderstanding that, so I hope somebody will correct me about that. But it's just to the extent that there needs to be some necessary or proper connection, and to the extent that the purpose, which I think Mr. Gruskin indicated, was to implement Amendment 41, I'm just having trouble understanding how it furthers the implementation of Article 29, and that's kind of where I'm stuck. I'm sort of leaning, so I keep leaning back and forth. But right now, leaning that this is just that the connection is so weak that it constitutes a separate subject. But as Eubanks, I think, indicated, there's things that could shore that connection up that aren't present. But that's kind of where I am right now. I don't know. Mr. Dunweather.
Under that analysis, then, wouldn't a if the measure specifically said the Ethics Commission, I think I phrase it, if there was a direct connection saying, you know, the amount connected and the amount funded shall be equal, under your analysis, wouldn't that also cause the same problem? Because even if it requires that nexus, what you're still doing is offsetting funds that would have to be taken from other agencies to fund it. In other words, I'm not sure that connection solves the concern you have.
I'm not sure what it would take. I mean, it seems to me the General Assembly can still arguably I'm not sure that I see that the occupation tax has any effect on what the General Assembly, how the General Assembly funds the Ethics Commission, if that's what you're asking. I mean, it seems to me that they have a constitutional obligation to adequately fund it, and this, because this measure doesn't provide a direct funding mechanism for that, rather it just simply in augments the general fund, it's just hard for me to see the connection. I don't know whether I'm responding to your question or not, but
I think so. I'm concerned that if you have a constitutional requirement that something be funded out of general fund, how do you ever get over that hurdle then of making that connection? Because then no matter what the connection is, you're still really offsetting revenues that have to be taken from elsewhere in the budget to meet that mandatory funding requirement. So even if it says, you know, the amount collected on lobbyists this year shall be a pro rata basis of the amount needed to fund the Ethics Commission in the prior year, so there's sort of a one-year lag on funding or something like that, what you're really still doing is offsetting the costs, the costs that were taken, or the expenditures that were taken from other agencies. I don't know if that advances the ball any, but I'm just trying to see where the line is.
I don't know. I don't have an answer. I mean, arguably, I'm just not sure that I believe this because the connection does seem so weak. But arguably, by not having to take reduce other agencies' appropriations, might encourage the General Assembly to view its appropriation responsibility for the Ethics Commission more liberally, because it's not going to cost other agencies in general fund appropriations. I just don't know whether I'm convinced by that. That's what I'm struggling with: is how does this advance the purposes of Amendment 41? Hard for me to see that it does very much, or if it does, it's pretty nebulous. One weakness, probably among many, but one weakness in my thinking here is that I don't, you know, when I look at the case law, you know, I among the things I'm looking at is that cases that say that an initiative that addresses subjects that have no necessary proper connection with one another shall be disallowed, and that and you look to whether there are separate purposes which are not dependent upon or connected to each other. And I'm not sure. It helps me if I can articulate a separate purpose that's not dependent or connected with, you know, the major purpose here. And I actually don't have a way of articulating what the separate purpose would even be here, other than to help other state agencies, which I don't actually believe. The purpose is to supplement the general fund for expenditures of the Ethics Commission. Maybe I should just take that at face value. And that's, I don't know that I could say that is not connected with Article 29. Directly connected.
Home.
And you would force us. A motion would force us to make a decision.
Oh, we can sit here somewhere.
I think really we might as well go ahead and have a motion and kind of see where people are.
Well, then
I don't know where I am. So.
Well, and I don't know if Mr. Dunn wants to say anything before we go that route. Then I'd go ahead and make a motion. Let's see. Where are we? The proposed initiative number 21 does not contain a single subject, and that the board not proceed to set a title.
I think for now, I'm not going to second the motion. It would require a second. If there is a, there may very well be, no matter what we decide, a motion for rehearing, and that certainly might influence my decision. But I think at this point, I'm probably going to err on the side of finding that there's a single subject. Is there a second? Okay. That motion dies for lack of a second. I will go ahead and then move that the board find that there is a single subject and that we proceed to set a title. Is there a second?
I'll second.
That's been moved and seconded. If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. Then let's proceed to the staff draft. Jesse is projecting it onto the screen. And Mr. Gruskin, have you had an opportunity to look at the staff draft, and do you have any comments?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I just had to kind of gather my papers because I didn't anticipate I'd be standing up here. That having been said, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to maybe give you some proposed thoughts on the staff draft. This really appears to be a significant change to the staff draft. A lot of it is just moving language around. If I could, Mr. Chairman, the first underlined section, I just moved that up so that all the tax-related provisions were together. So that's the only change in that phrase. It seems to me that the provisions that are stricken, while I don't have any problem with them substantively, I'll reflect current law as enacted by Senate Bill 210. And typically the court says you don't have to repeat existing law in a ballot title, or even talk about how the proposed change would affect existing law. So, as many people sometimes do, I'm suggesting that might be shorter just to omit that, but I don't have any substantive problem with it, with one exception. The first word that's stricken is the word restricting. Section 9, as you know, prompted a huge brouhaha over whether or not restrictions or limitations could be part of the implementation of Amendment 41, and the legislature even changed Senate Bill 210 because the original draft use that verbiage. So it seems to me that specifying is probably more appropriate if you're going to include that phrase. I did, however, include some of the changes to existing law, because I think that that is something that arguably the voters would want to know, and it really relates to the fact that it requires only three members of the commission to issue a subpoena, and it requires only a majority rather than two-thirds of each house to approve the legislative members. Those are the only changes I'd make. I don't think they're very notable, really. I would note that the memorandum from OSPB appears to be based upon the original $50 tax, so it might be overstating the fiscal impact, at least of professional lobbyists as registered with the Secretary of State. So as to filling in the blank in the title, you may want to consider the change that was made in the text that OSPB may not have been told about.
The language that you propose to strike, I think you're saying that's in Senate Bill 210, basically, that those items are in Senate Bill 210.
Correct.
And I think there is some case law to the effect that constitutionalizing something is a change. And my notes indicate, and I can't tell you much more than that, but it related to codifying, actually in this case the Supreme Court's decision, that Tabor could not be repealed in a single measure. And this related to number 43, which I think was a petition rights proposal. And the court said constitutionalizing this rule is an undeniable departure from the present circumstances. And I think at least that was actually significant for single subject purposes, even, I think. But I'm just wondering, especially to the extent that there may be some things that in Senate Bill 210 that are not necessarily settled law, that maybe nevertheless it could be significant. I don't know. I'm trying to think that through. But.
Well, I think it's a good point. I'd forgotten about that case law, so I appreciate your putting it on the table. I think that the the emphasis, the legislature's emphasis in passing 210 was that it was simply clarifying Article 29 in light of the verbiage that was already in there in Sections 1 and 6. I don't have any objection.
I mean, I guess for purposes of the titles, we're on the one hand we want them brief, but we also, on the other hand, want to make sure we identify the major features. And I just don't know how that shakes out. I mean, the point's well taken. If you know, to the extent this is simply repeating what the current law does say, maybe it's not significant.
Well, let me suggest this. If you were to include, starting from the premise that if you constitutionalize something, it's a change voters should know about, I'm not really sure what the first phrase that begins with the word restricting and ends with the word private gain, five lines down, really says or really adds. Because the next provision begins requiring the commission to dismiss as frivolous. Really says everything that I think you need to say, because that's what Senate Bill 210 did. That the first phrase seems to be kind of the overarching reference, and the only thing it does is include the breach of the public trust standard, which I think you could include in the second phrase so that we're to read requiring the commission to dismiss as frivolous any complaint that fails to allege a covered individual solicited, accepted, or received any gift or thing of value in violation of the public trust for private gain or personal financial gain. So I think you could probably condense them together. And then the only thing I'd note is that covered individual referred back to that phrase that I would strike if because it lumps the four categories, public officials, General Assembly members, local government officials, and local government employees together as such covered individuals. So you may need that lengthier phrase in there. And you may find that going from a two-thirds to a majority of each house is an aspect of the measure. And I wouldn't have any problem with that because I don't really think it is. But it seems to me that erring on the cautious side. Excuse me.
Any other comments or is there any questions for Mr. Gruskin? Ms. Eubanks?
Mr. Gruskin, in terms of the statement of the single subject, and you have the same in your draft as what was in the staff draft, and understanding that, you know, we're trying to comply with the Tabor ballot language, and that causes some difficulties in terms of trying to then make this statement of single subject. It seems to me that some of the changes made in your measure, while they relate to the implementation of Article 29, you know, the way that the single subject is stated, it's the imposition of a tax to implement, and I'm not sure that, I mean, it sort of gives the impression that, you know, the tax is to fund implementation, and that's all the measure does. I'm afraid that maybe that statement of single subject is a little bit too limited, because then you have, you know, for the, for example, you know, you've gone into more detail, as was done in 210, about how the House and the Senate appoint members and things like that. So, I mean, you have other provisions relating to the enforcement, the implementation of the measure, but I don't know that it's always just the tax. And so I'm just afraid that the statement right now is perhaps too limited. Not that I know how to fix it, but I just like your thoughts. I mean, are you comfortable with the statement of single subject?
Well, again, as a matter of economy, my original cut, I just struck the phrase after occupational tax on professional lobbyists. But out of deference to the drafter and in light of the board's concern sometimes to provide more language in that original, in that originating phrase, I left it in. I'm not at all tied to it. It seems to me that clearly the tax used to fund the commission will relate to all the provisions in terms of how the commission operates, including how they're appointed. I'm not tied to that language at all, and I think that you could probably change it some or delete it even without doing violence, because the "and in connection therewith" is so explicit that it would be hard not to understand what the tax was being used in connection with. So,
what would you think if, for the statement of single subject, if you went more toward implementation of state constitutional provisions, imposing standards of conduct by persons, blah, blah, blah? I mean, in terms of a more general statement, I mean, you'd still have your Tabor language, and then, you know, the first clause, once you get past "in connection therewith," you have reference to the occupational tax. I mean, do you have any feel for that, or do you think it's important to have reference to the occupational tax in the statement of single subject?
What I'm looking for, frankly, is the, I know this issue came up over the lottery ballot title, and it was particularly because you used to describe that an amendment to the Colorado Constitution to generate tourism funds and in connection therewith. That, as a precursor to a measure that substantively changed what the lottery did, substantially changed how the lottery funds went, and then also, by the way, created the promotion fund. The Supreme Court had, believe me, I tried to create a bellyache for the Supreme Court over that language, and they didn't blink. So even that kind of very succinct language is more than adequate.
Okay, so you're comfortable if we, it's just as is. You're okay with that. You don't feel like that leaves you exposed in some way, that the single subject doesn't encompass all the provisions of your measure.
Well, I've never been quite as focused on this as the board has. I know that you really like that initial phrase, the overarching umbrella. But for instance, when you said concerning an amendment to the Colorado Constitution to generate tourism funding, you didn't even mention video lottery terminals in there. The Supreme Court didn't have a problem with that. So, I mean, you authorized a whole new lottery program, and the court said, well, obviously. So I think I'm not sure that this language is perfect, and my bet is that Mr. Gessler will help us figure out what's wrong with it. And I'm more than open to any comments, but it seems to me that that what the tax does is it does implement state constitutional provisions relating to the standards of conduct.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Gessler, would you like to comment on the staff draft or on Mr. Gruskin's suggested revisions?
No.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to testify? If not, I'll turn to board discussion on the staff draft and Mr. Gruskin's suggested alternatives. On the last point, I actually wonder if it wouldn't, in this case, be beneficial taking, I think, Ms. Eubanks' suggestion or question about just concerning implementation of state constitutional provisions. And that may be inconsistent in a way, but it just seemed like the occupational tax is so incidental here. We sort of make it sound like that's what this whole measure is about. And I don't know that I can distinguish, but it seemed like in other situations where a new measure both raises a lot of revenue and then dedicates the proceeds, that's different than here where we already have the measure and we're not, it's to me more incidental that there's an occupation tax added to it that does not fully fund the measure that's already in place. So I don't know, it seems like it's the current articulation of the subject in the staff draft seems odd to me. So even though I think an attempt to try to follow the pattern that we've been using, but I'm just curious what the thoughts of the other board members may be.
I think I'm in agreement that I think to have a little bit broader statement and perhaps drop the reference to the occupational tax actually helps in terms of ensuring that the statement of single subject covers everything. It just seems very limited right now, and I'm not sure that it's quite as limited as the title provides.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure about the other potential changes, but maybe I'll just go ahead and make a motion to see if I'm on the right track here. If we were to basically strike beginning in line two after the beginning with imposition, strike everything to the end of the line, and the next word as well, strike the word implement, and insert implementation of. The first clause after the in connection therewith states the occupational tax. I don't know whether what's left after striking most of line two and the first word in line three, I mean, if whether that's the adequate explanation or articulation of the single subject, but my major objective maybe would be just to strike the reference to the imposition of the occupation tax. Any comment? I'll move that. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further suggested changes to the staff draft? Ms. Eubanks?
I sort of hate to bring the subject even up after our previous discussion about supplementing the general fund and what all that means. To make the title, I think, more accurately reflect the language of the measure, and I'm referring to the phrase there on line six primarily, after it's, you know, it's describing the occupational tax. I'm a little uncomfortable with the wording of the staff draft, just because that seems to be a more explicit statement of that it's actually providing monies to support the commission, when in fact I'm not sure the measure says that. And perhaps it could be tweaked something along the lines to say that it's to supplement monies in the state's general fund expended to support the Ethics Commission, which I think, as I understand Mr. Gruskin's explanation, is sort of the purpose of the tax. It's to supplement those monies out of the fund that are expended, but it isn't necessarily that these funds in particular are expended to provide the fund. And so I don't know whether you're interested in viewing some changes, but there on line six, Ceci, after supplement, you would insert monies in, and then after general fund, strike the language to provide monies. Can't get that two back. There you go. And insert expended.
Right there?
Yes.
What's the word?
Expended, EXP. END, yeah. And I'd be interested in Mr. Gruskin's. Are you okay with that?
I am. It does occur to me that the phrase in the amount of $25 annually, well, the tax is set $25 in the first year in 2008, and you may want to make it clear that it's in the amount of $25 in 2008, and then in the next phrase make it clear that it's in future years permitting General Assembly to increase or decrease.
I think we have that.
Could perhaps your concern on line five, if we say in the initial amount of 25?
Well, yeah, where it says on line six annually, that kind of implies that it's an ongoing, I don't know if it implies an ongoing tax or not.
Well, it is an annual tax.
Yeah.
It's imposed.
About $25
but not
in the first
25.
Year.
Okay.
It just occurred to me. I mean, it may well be enough that where it starts on line seven, permitting the General Assembly to increase or decrease the occupational tax, informs voters that there is flexibility that the tax will change. And if that's so, then I'm just being a tad anal.
Would it help to say $25 in the first year? Is it 25 in the first year? I think it has to be, doesn't it?
I think, although it's based on a fiscal year basis, right?
per year.
Oh, no. You impose it starting January 1st, 2008. Oh, but the fiscal year goes to when they can adjust the rate.
I'm okay with it the way it is, but I don't feel strongly about it.
Well, I think you do get the adjustment concept there in the later phrase on line 7. But I'm okay, maybe you just say in the initial amount of $25 annually, because it could be $25 for several. I mean, if the GA doesn't change the rate right away.
I'm fine with the way it is.
So, Ceci, if you put up on line 5 and say before the word amount, say initial. I would move those changes.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
Further chair?
You may.
I would, on the next phrase where it does talk about the General Assembly adjusting the rate, whether we need to say so long as revenues from the tax do not annually exceed 90% of general fund or 90% of annual general fund expenditures, something, I don't know, maybe the concept of fiscal year later gets it, but it's a year-to-year determination, it seems like, and never mind.
You want to say online? Well, what is it
well,
about?
I was going to
think.
Not
annually exceed?
Yeah. Do not annually exceed 90%. And I think it should be general fund expenditures for the commission rather than on the commission. They're on line 9. I would at least make that change. Just change on to 4.
Then you also want to add on line 8, do not annually exceed?
Yes.
Motion?
I'd move those changes.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
Can I go back to the single subject? Description of persons professionally involved with governmental activities. I think that's tough for the layperson to, without deciphering the measure in Article 29 itself, figure out what that's referring to. In fact, I'm not sure what it's referring to. Is that the lobbyist side or the governmental employee side of things?
Both.
And I think that may be why
did
we use that phrase in Amendment 41?
Yeah.
Mr. Griskin?
I don't know that phrase is actually used in 41, but that comes from your ballot title on 41.
Yeah,
and I frankly think it sets the standard, which I never really enunciated during the legislative fight, for Senate Bill 210. I mean, it draws the nexus clearly to people who deal with government and not neighbors or people who have social relationships. So to the extent that this measure takes those clearly enunciated standards from 210 and makes them part of Article 29, I think it's probably accurate.
Yeah, the ballot title for Amendment 41 began an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning standards of conduct by persons who are professionally involved with governmental activities. And I think it's because, again, for purposes of single subject, we were trying to avoid listing different types of individuals with a conjunction.
But that's not accurate, is it? Because it's not just people who are professionally involved. If a citizen essentially attempts to give a gift to a legislator and asks for a vote in return, that's a violation of Amendment 41 under any reading, right?
If a citizen, if a person seeks to give a gift to a legislator or any other policymaker because they are trying to influence their official act.
So it's not just those professionally involved with governmental activities. It's broader.
I have no idea what happened at the title board a year ago. But
I didn't do that.
My imagination is that draws a distinction between a social contact. In other words, it's professionally involved as to the governmental official or employee.
But I think that Mr. Dunn may be asking the question because of the provision in Section 6, which is the penalty provision, that it talks about, you know, any public officer, member of the General Assembly, blah, 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 you know, employee or official who breaches the public trust for private gain and any person or entity inducing such breach shall be liable. So it seems like, I mean, obviously, if I took something that I wasn't supposed to, I could be penalized. But also the person who gave it to me could be penalized, and whether those people are professionally involved, I think that's perhaps where Mr. Dunn was coming from.
Well, do you want to strike the word professionally?
That help? Sufficiently vague if we say imposing standards of conduct relating to governmental activities? In other words, are we, I hate to water it down so much that no one knows what it means, but maybe that is accurate.
Okay with me.
After conduct, just say relating to and then strike to governmental activities.
Sorry for that.
Yeah.
Any comment?
I mean, you all were here a year ago. I wasn't, so I don't know what the conversation was. But it seems to get it away from the fact that there are relationships, transactions, if you will, that are at issue. And it also takes it out of the realm of the people who are involved. It makes it, emphasizes the activities. It's not the activities that are being regulated, it's the extracurricular nature of relationships involving governmental officials.
Would it make more, or would it be more accurate to say standards of conduct for persons involved in governmental activities? Kind of vague too, though. Sort of goes to the problem with Amendment 41 itself.
Is the giver of a gift that may violate Amendment 41 involved in governmental activities? I mean, just because they've given the gift to a person that's subject to the gift ban? That make that person that's giving the gift involved in governmental activities?
That was sort of the assumption I was making. If you're giving a gift to someone to influence their public decision making, then you're necessarily involved in governmental activities.
Could I suggest, again, I think that the phrase by persons professionally involved with governmental activities suggests that it has to do with people who are, as Mr. Dunn pointed out, trying to affect the actual governmental acts. I think probably a briefer way of saying exactly the same thing would just be to say implementation of state constitutional provisions imposing governmental standards of conduct.
Say that again?
Just impose governmental before standards of conduct. And then it makes it clear, rather than using the professionally involved with governmental activities, that it is the government acting in its, you know, official capacity.
You're saying put governmental right there?
Yeah, and strike everything else.
But then it implies that it's only the governmental employee's conduct that it's at issue.
Not necessarily.
Imposing governmental standards of conduct?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Could we say something like standards of conduct relating to governmental actors and those attempting to influence their decisions or something like that, you know, governmental employees and public officials and those attempting to influence decision making or something like that.
Well, you've just added a lot more words to the title. That was something that we struggled with last time around because you have the lobbyists aspect of it as well as the officials and employees. Now, I don't know that what we did on the title for 41 necessarily recognizes this additional issue about the giver of something that constitutes a breach of conduct.
Can I suggest that the language that you used in 41 had to be broad enough to encompass both Section 3, which is the gift ban, and Section 4, which was the revolving door? And therefore, you needed language that was as expansive as this. Since this measure doesn't pretend to govern Section 4, you've got a liberty that you didn't have with last year. I wish that led me to a point where I said, therefore, the magic wording is, but I really hadn't thought about it early enough.
Could I ask Mr. Dunn a question? Is Section 4 of Article 29, is that part of the lawsuit? Is that being challenged?
No.
The revolving door provision isn't at issue? Okay.
We say something along the lines of imposing standards of conduct relating to the giving and receiving of gifts and things of values to governmental employees. Is that too narrow?
I wonder if it's too narrow. I'm troubled by a conjunction. I think I heard single subject. But we'd like to avoid.
With the giving and receiving?
Yeah.
Is that the convention?
Yeah.
Well, I think I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure in this case that would be a serious concern. But.
I mean, I'm not sure we're adding much to it, no matter what we do. I mean, I'm okay with the changes the way we have them. I mean, I don't have any strong feeling about any of the approaches that have been suggested, but.
The way we have it right now?
My two favorite are either that what we have marked as changes, possible changes right now, standards of conduct relating to governmental activities, or alternatively, standards of conduct by persons involved with governmental activities. I think dropping the word professionally, I think that was the original concern.
Yeah, maybe that's fine, just dropping professionally. Want to go back to that? I think you need to redo your last change on annually. There you go.
Strike professionally?
Yeah.
Is that okay? I'll move that change.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Let me raise the one of Mr. Gruskin's suggestions, which was to include a clause about our noting that the proposal excludes the revenues raised by the tax from any existing restrictions on spending revenues or appropriations. Should we include that in the list of features?
I think in general that would be consistent with what we've done on other measures that have the same sort of debriefing language. Go ahead and include a statement so the voters know that these revenues are outside of any taper limitations, as well as, especially in this case, with it, the money's going to the general fund, I assume, in terms of a 6% limit. Issue on the arbor scale bird limit, so to give notice of that, I think is fine.
Well, let's insert where the cursor is then, the clause excluding the revenues raised by the tax from any existing restrictions on spending, comma.
Say from any existing.
from any existing restrictions.
Went in one door and out the other.
Semicolon.
Except appropriations missing.
And then you would have that very same clause on that.
Oh.
You're moving it up.
Oh, that's right.
Up
I forgot
tax.
That. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
19. On 19, starting with excluding. Yeah.
Okay. Could have just cut and pasted. I forgot. Sorry. I'll move that change.
Do you need a semicolon right there?
Yeah. Do we typically do that before the and? So.
I do. Yes.
Jobs.
What's the question?
Do we need a semicolon right there?
Where the cursor is?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
The final.
I think so.
We do have it in the original version.
Because you struck it.
Don't we? Yeah.
Oh. Because we struck it at line 20, so just need to have it somewhere before the and.
Okay.
I think.
Before you make your motion, I think up on line 11, Ceci, appropriations need to
yes.
Okay. Hold.
I'll move that change. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
May I ask Mr. Gruskin a question? In terms of the changes that you're proposing on being much more specific about the number of members needed to issue a subpoena or in terms of majority of the Senate or the House to approve that body's appointment, really think you need that much detail?
What was the second part of that?
In terms of he's suggesting specifying that a majority of the Senate has to approve the commission member appointed by the president and a majority of the House to appoint the commission member appointed by the speaker, which is I agree it's a change from 210 because it requires two-thirds approval of each body for the speaker and president's appointments, but I'm just wondering in terms of sort of being a major component of your measure.
I defer to your...
I
put it in there only because it was a change. I wasn't sure if it was major.
I think it is excessive detail. I'm not even sure the subpoena clause needs to be in there. I don't know if you feel strongly about the subpoena. Not just your change, but reference to the subpoena at all.
Because again, the change on the subpoena under 210 is 4, yeah. And so you are changing the number, but concept's the same in terms of you got to have most of the members of the commission agree to the subpoena.
So, maybe I'll make a motion.
Okay.
Let's see, where are we now on here? On line 17, right there, starting with restricting. Mm-hmm. Actually, strike that all the way to the next strike. That strikes any reference to subpoena.
Strike all the way to documents?
Yes. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but
I don't know. That's a major component of the measure.
Okay. So
I'll move that.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
So getting back to sort of the heart of Mr. Grushin's changes, in terms of what's being stricken versus the case law, in terms of sort of constitutionalizing things, especially in when you think of what's being done in the measure as clarification of the provisions of Article 29 anyway, because of the concepts of breach of the public trust for private gain that are currently in what is it, the is 1 and 6, the penalty provision? That if it's just truly a clarification, I mean, and you don't really have that statement, I mean, that's sort of the effect of the changes made, but you never have that actual statement. I think I'm probably in an agreement that, one, we should be removing the phrase that starts there on line 11, talking about restricting, because if it really is clarifying existing law versus actually changing law, and I know that's a matter of dispute depending on people's interpretation, that you wouldn't describe it as a restriction or necessarily a change. Now, I may feel differently about the whether we include the change about the commission dismissing as frivolous, and maybe that's where we get into constitutionalizing something and you should include that statement. But I would move that we strike the language there at where the cursor is on line 11 all the way into line 15, private gain, semicolon.
Well, I'm just perhaps not knowledgeable enough. I can see it both ways. I guess I can see that that's both as I understand it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Both that the measure supports an interpretation of existing Article 29, first of all, and I think it's also already reflected now in, or if the governor signs 210?
And he has.
And he has. So it's also an accurate reflection of existing statutory law. I guess I'm just balking a little bit just because it seemed like that was a debated point about whether or not that's an accurate interpretation of Amendment Article 29 now. I thought this was a fairly significant issue about the scope of the restrictions in Article 29. But, I mean, I don't feel strongly about it, but it just seemed like this was a really major issue in the public discussions.
And I don't disagree with that. I don't know that the measure actually says this anyplace. I mean, when it talks about the definition of private gain and makes an official act, and then the way it ties it in, those terms are for purposes of the commission dismissing as frivolous. But in terms of the underlying, whether 29 initially provided for, that its operation was limited already to breach of the public trust for private gain because of existing language in 29 versus now providing that the commission dismiss as frivolous a complaint that doesn't allege breach of the public trust for private gain. I mean, the measure itself, I mean, that language is almost, an interpretation. I mean, aside whether you say it's restricting or clarifying, I mean, you're interpreting the measure versus sort of reflecting a statement of the measure? Because the only way, at least my understanding, and you know, Lord knows I've been dealing with this stuff way too long and can get confused, but the only way that those concepts are currently pulled into the constitutional provision by this initiative is by requiring the commission to dismiss complaints.
Is that right? I mean, you probably are right, but I'm looking at the measure, section 2 of the measure, that adds a new subsection that says the gift ban only applies.
Well, yeah, I guess that, because that wasn't in 210, was it? That is.
Yes.
It is.
Yeah, in your section 2 of the initiative, which creates the 3.5 in section 3, that is new. That isn't something that 210 had.
No, that is in 210.
It is in 210? Okay.
So to the, I mean, to the.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry.
I don't feel strongly about it. I was thinking of this as being such a big issue that, making a reference about it bothers me a little bit. But again, it's as I understand it. Again, it's an interpretation of Article 29 right now, and it's reflected in Senate Bill 210. I mean, this does constitutionalize that interpretation and that statute. And maybe that just doesn't rise to the level of something that's that significant.
Well, it is sort of a major underlying principle of Article 29. I mean, I think if you feel like we should include it, I don't know that restricting or clarifying at the beginning of the phrase would be the way to go, whether it's just specifying, so it's not getting into the idea of this is an actual change or it's not, even though the measure talks about in the applicability that it's clarification, you know, whether you just say that it specifies the operation if you want to include it.
I think I prefer that, but you know, I don't mind being a minority here, but I think I prefer saying specifying that the operation, or yes, I'm not sure how to say that, but just again, without saying whether it's a clarification or a restriction, saying this is what it does.
You want to remove the strike through?
How is specifying different than restricting? Or excuse me, specifying different than clarifying?
Clarifying, to me, I mean, it takes the position that's what Article 29
already says,
and understanding that some people agree with that statement and some people don't. And just like restricting, that would be taking the position that currently 29 isn't limited to breach of the public trust for private gain.
So how is specifying different than?
It's just making a statement. It's not really saying that it's a change or that this is. It doesn't have an underlying. At least in my mind, it doesn't have an underlying message that either 29 does or doesn't currently include this concept.
By specifying that the operation of the existing ban does X, Y, and Z, isn't that sort of clarifying? I don't have a problem with it. I think that is though the import of it.
I'm not sure that I can be really helpful, but I would point you to Section 11, which states that it's the voter's intent that the adoption of these provisions clarify existing law. Now, I think what the legislature has already done. And obviously, the advantage that provision is that it insulates this measure from a charge of retroactivity. And it's intended that the voters know that, intended to reflect that the voters know that what they're doing is clarifying existing law, in part as it exists under Article 29, and in part as it's been reflected in Senate Bill 210. I'm not making a recommendation to you one way or the other, but I think that the measure itself is clear enough that this is already the standard that exists, and that the voters are simply adopting or embracing that.
So perhaps, can you use the word clarifying? Because that is what the measure states. Clarifying that.
Yeah, I seem like we run into difficulty further on here. That I don't know how to, if we do, I don't know how to fix it right off.
I would move that change.
I'll second it for purposes of discussion. Do we need something more? Let's see. It would read then, clarifying that the operation of the existing constitutional bans on the solicitation, acceptance, or receipt of gifts or things of value by a public officer, member of the General Assembly, local government official, or government employee. And here's where I run into trouble. It clarifies that the operation of those existing provisions. Do we need something like applies to such covered officials whose solicitation, et cetera, is a breach of the public trust, or applies only to such covered individuals whose, et cetera, is a breach of the public trust for private gain? It's an awfully long clause, and I just keep getting lost in it.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it, the difficulty is because of the restricting term. That's why it was written that way.
Mm-hmm, right.
That you've changed it may.
Yeah, you mean applies right on line 13. Apply
after.
Right after employee.
Yes.
Right there.
Apply, and maybe even applies only to, or only applies, I'm not sure which, but I'm trying to reaffirm this is a restriction, but it's a clarification, but it's a limitation.
I think applies only to petition acceptance.
But that doesn't cover the giver then, does it? Gift giver.
Clarifying that existing constitutional provisions ban having to receive a gift, blah, 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 that reflect the breach of the public trust request. This clause right here in the middle, that kind of is the stuff.
Go over that again. So
clarifying that existing constitutional provisions ban
the solicitation.
Ban okay. Solicitation, acceptance, or receipt of gifts and things valued by public officer members of the assembly, government official, or government employee that reflect a breach of the public trust or private gain.
Or constitute a breach?
I think constitute's a better word.
Okay.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Try that. I'm a little lost.
For us to say, Sessie's down there going,
yeah, do that, Sessie.
Yeah, really. I didn't know you were so talented.
Clarifying that the constitutional...
That existing constitutional provisions ban...
Okay, so after constitutional, insert... Provisions.
Ban singular.
Ban singular. And take out on the.
Just take, yeah.
Take out log.
Take those three words out. Well, okay.
And isn't the solicitation?
And solicitation, acceptance, or receipt of gifts. Blah, 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 blah.
And the solicitation, acceptance. Mm-hmm. I think we need the.
Need the. Okay. And is it ban? Provisions ban?
Yeah, it's a verb.
Okay. So just. Okay.
Then I think you go down to line 14. Strike the language in red now to undo that.
Like this?
No.
Yep.
Go on.
And then strike the language starting there to such covered employees. Keep going. All the way through that line.
All the way to where?
All the way through line 14, and then on line 15, to right there. Okay, strike that. And then insert constitutes.
That constitutes.
Should it be constitute
singular?
Singular?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Constitution. I'll move
that. Second.
Seconded.
So it would read, I'm still having a little trouble reading it, so if you don't mind, bear with me. It would read, clarifying that the existing constitutional provisions ban the solicitation, acceptance, or receipt of gifts or things of value by a public officer, member of the General Assembly, or local government official, or government employee that constitute a breach of the public trust for private gain, semicolon. No, that last clause, that constitute
a
breach, seems to kind of be hanging there in a way that I'm stumbling over.
Did it say when constituting a breach of the public trust for private gain?
Be better.
Versus something like prohibits? I mean, is that...
Don't we want to say instead of when constituting, we want to say if the solicitation, acceptance, or receipt of such gift or thing of value constitutes a breach of the public trust for private gain?
It's longer, but it sounds... I think it kind of connects the two parts of that clause together
right.
Better. So, what was it again? If
one second. Could you just say if doing so, or do you need to list them all?
How about when doing so constitutes a breach? I don't know at this point.
Constitutes.
I know if the existing constitution is great.
But just if doing so breaches the public trust for private gain.
Go for it.
I see a lot of resignation over here. I'll try that. If doing so constitutes.
Constitutes what?
That's good.
That's it.
Where you are?
That's right.
And then there's the question of whether or not ban should be, in line 12, should be prohibits or prohibit, or some better word.
Fine with ban.
I think I'm okay with ban. But. Okay. So, what we have is...
Oh, yeah, I'll withdraw that motion. Move what we have up there.
Is there a second?
Second.
Yeah. So it would read clarifying that the existing constitutional provisions ban the solicitation, acceptance, or receipt of gifts or things of value by a public officer, member of the General Assembly, local government official, or government employee if doing so constitutes a breach of the public trust for private gain.
Better. Last chance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion passes 3-0. It's you, Banks.
Sorry, go ahead.
Do
we need, then, requiring the commission to dismiss as frivolous a complaint that fails to allege blah, 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 if we're already saying that if something doesn't breach, it's not banned?
Can we strike that?
I would move, then, to strike right there. I guess all the way to the next strike.
All of it?
I'll second. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the last phrase about the reenactment, two issues. One, which I sort of alluded to in my questions about whether you have to explain more about what you're doing. Right now I don't feel terribly inclined to do, but I think that's maybe an issue that we want to talk about, just so people know what it is that they're reenacting and whether that's that you actually include the specific subsections of Article 29. The other thing is that I don't know that struck down by a court is, one, accurate, and two, I don't know that Joe Blow off the street's going to know what that really means. And not that I've thought of a good way of describing that, but perhaps relying a little bit more on the language of the measure to talk about if the provisions are found unconstitutional or suspended or something like that. But I just don't know that struck down is very helpful to voters.
Instead of saying struck down, if we said
invalidated
or suspended by a court.
Yeah, just.
Isn't the point, and Mr. Grusin, you can correct me if I'm wrong, isn't the point that because these are modifications to the existing law, if the existing law is struck down, you sort of have the modification floating out there in the Constitution by itself. And so the modification is part and parcel with what's in law. Well, I don't know. That's a...
I mean, in a way, this provision, at least the way I view it, is sort of corrective in nature. I mean, if the court has invalidated, it's sort of making the assumption that these... the other changes incorporated in the measure will cure
right.
the grounds for which it was invalidated, and so that you're recreating it with these new provisions, sort of it's starting fresh. I mean, I think is what it's trying to do. And so I'm okay with, you know, because I do think that's important. I think people need to know that there's this sort of broader implication relating to provisions that aren't contained in the measure itself. But if we say invalidated by a court, I think that might be sufficient for that, and then we can talk about whether or not we need to give more notice about which ones, or whether that's an issue of if they really want to know, they can look at the measure itself. But
right. the point is not just that it's reenacting, because that sounds kind of odd to say, well, we're just readopting a provision that was thrown out by a court. I mean, what it's really doing is it's using language that happens to be from a measure that was thrown out by a court, modifying it and reconstituting it. So it's a new provision, and maybe the way to say that is reenacting and modifying specified provisions.
It's not really, because when a court invalidates it, it still appears in the Constitution. It may have a citation saying that the
right.
court has found this to be, but it isn't repealed. It's not removed.
Right.
It still exists. It doesn't have any force and effect of
right.
law. So I don't. I mean,
so you're saying it's not accurate to say reenactment and modification of specified provisions? I'm just trying to convey the point that it's not just simply the reenactment of old provision. It's the point of the whole thing is to reenact those and then modify them in a way that in theory makes them constitutional.
Well, would you get to that if you said constitutes reenactment of specified provisions of Article 29 of the State Constitution as modified by this measure?
Sure.
If the provisions are struck down, something like, I mean... Jesse, you want to... go ahead and insert there, as modified by this measure. Probably.
I think so, yeah. Should we offset that phrase?
Put a comma up front and at the end.
Mr. Gerskin?
You said in the earlier phrase that clarifying. So, wonder whether or not clarified as opposed to modified is appropriate.
So you'd suggest as clarified by this measure?
And then I think it provides exactly the context that
right, because it does, I mean, because the language of the provision says before these clarifying amendments are adopted, so I'm fine with that if you want to say as clarified.
Are we okay with that?
Do we need the introductory part of that clause as well, and specifying that voter approval of the proposed measure shall constitute? Why not just strike all that and just say reenacting specified provisions of Article 29 of the state constitution as clarified by the measure if provisions are struck down? I'll try that.
Shall we do, can we finish this one and
make
that change?
Sure.
Well, I would move this change as reflected on the screen.
Second.
Any other discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no.
Mine was an aye.
That was a 3-0. Yeah, that passes. Thank you.
Now if you...
So then strike from and all the way to...
So strike and also?
I think you still need the and.
Oh, you're right.
The last
and
phrase.
Reenacting, so. Change, yeah. You strike all that and then change reenactment to reenacting.
Might as well just strike reenactment one.
Then strike of.
That's a motion.
Second.
Second. And any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
Can we go back down to my struck down language? Down on line 1 of the next page? To strike struck down and substitute invalidated.
I'll second that. That's a motion.
Motion. So moved.
Any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further suggested changes to the staff draft, Mr. Gruskin.
Just a note, you've inserted a reference on line 22 as clarified by this measure. Then at the end, by accordance for the proposed measure, we just maybe say before this measure is approved? Already referred to.
I'll move that.
I'll second.
This measure.
Strike the proposed.
This.
This. Yeah.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Anything else?
Mr. Grushin, do you feel strongly about the references? You think that if people really are interested in which provisions, then they can look at the measure, or do you think we should specify? Okay. I'll leave it be.
Okay. Is there a motion to adopt the title as amended by the board with the understanding that the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause?
I'll move.
Without the, it's just easier without the strike type now. Can you give us a minute?
Oh, we're not done, are we? We have a blank.
Oh. Yeah.
I think Mr. Gruskin pointed out that the we have an OSPB fiscal analysis with an estimate that's based on a $50 fee. So presumably, if we rely on the OSPB fiscal estimate, then the amount of the tax increase should probably be cut in half, $29,650. $14,825. I guess I would move that we strike the blank and insert 14,000, comma 825, dollar sign 14,825. Mr. Gruskin, any comment?
I have one question. I know I wasn't here the last meeting. Mr. Domenico was in here for the Attorney General, and he raised concerns. I can't remember what the context was, but that the dollar amount was unknown, and he felt uncomfortable expressing an amount that may not accurately reflect the amount raised, and that seems to be a similar concern here, that certainly could be more than the 14,825 annually. And I don't know if we have maybe the mandatory language of Tabor prohibits it, but do we want to say shall taxes be increased at least or something like that?
Mr. Gruskin?
I think that change would be probably a good one, because there are likely to be local professional lobbyists who are not accounted for on the Secretary of State's list. I don't think there are a significant number of professional lobbyists just relative to the state number, but there are, and I can think, I'm sure you all can think of a handful as well, those who state work, and therefore some language that make it clear that I think that also takes into consideration Mr. Dunn's proposal, the fact that the legislature can increase the tax.
And on that point, I think that is problematic, because again, as I understand it, this would actually be a ceiling. I mean, we have to put in the amount of the annual increase.
Well, that's true, but then you also have in this particular measure the language that says the General Assembly can change the rate, and that constitute approval of this measure constitutes future voter approval of rate increases. So I don't know how that would work exactly, but I think it may make the circumstances different than when we've talked about how the limit applies now. I mean, my guess is a court would be would not be very inclined to overturn voter approval of the measure in terms of if the GA, pursuant to its authority, raises the rate and makes the revenue exceed this estimate because the way it's been incorporated into the text of the measure and voters have approved it.
I mean, and whatever amount we put in there, we've informed the reader that the amount can be increased or decreased, and we've also informed the reader that, see line 9, that the revenues raised are exempt. I mean, if I'm understanding your points, I think it may not matter what amount we put in there, other than the fact that at least the estimate that we have right now is that this is the annual amount. But I think maybe we don't. I think you're suggesting, Ms. Eubanks, we don't necessarily have to worry about that being a limitation.
Well, I would just say that I think this is different than those circumstances where we've discussed the purpose of the dollar amount on other measures, because this measure is different from that aspect of allowing for the rate to be modified, with the idea, especially right now, based on the fiscal information, that the 14.8 is only a small share of the 132,000 that was currently appropriated in terms of the cost of the commission. So knowing that the rate can go up to generate at least 90% of the 132 or whatever that amount is in the future. I think someone at least would argue to a court that the 14.825 is not going to be binding like it would on other measures. Because Tabor envisions whatever is being proposed in terms of a tax increase, and if it generates more revenues, well, here you're specifically authorizing the generation of more revenues under the context of the measure in terms of the adjustment of the rate, and that future voter approval isn't required. And I'm just...
Does it change that? I was just looking at the mandatory language in Tabor. The parenthetical says, you know, shall, in this case, state taxes be increased, and then the parenthetical is first or phased-in final full fiscal year dollar increase. So it only requires the first year increase.
Right. And I think that's always been true. I don't know that the phase-in would be applicable here because
right.
it's not. But, yeah, it's only the first year.
So that actually gets us around the legislative change because that would be a second year, right?
Right.
Well.
But then what if after this goes into effect, what's the number they use, 600 and something? They use... They say just under 600 lobbyists.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you could have more lobbyists, or you know,
right.
the local government lobbyists factor is higher than what you think. So perhaps that would be the limitation for the first year, but in the future years, at least in terms of any going above that amount due to the change of the rate, I think at least someone would argue that. Voter approval gets you out of that refund situation if the revenues exceed the 14.825. But obviously, I can't make that argument for whoever that might be. But that's.
I think partly because we're really constrained by the required language of Tabor, but also because it not only mentions the legislative adjustment in there, but also that the and in connection therewith imposing an occupational tax on lobbyists in the initial amount of $25 annually. So it contemplates not only that it's initially $25, but it's a lobbyist-wide tax, and that anybody reading this is going to realize it's 25 times the number of lobbyists rather than a hard dollar amount.
One possible thought, just based on what Ms. Eubanks said, on line 6 where it starts permitting, it would also be possible, even though you don't have to refer back to Tabor, say providing... that this measure constitutes voter approval for the General Assembly to increase or decrease, so that you get both concepts, so that people know that.
Or maybe you could do it even more short form in terms of permitting the General Assembly without future voter approval to increase.
Okay.
And what does that add?
After General Assembly, say... Insert
comma.
Without, yeah, comma, without future voter approval, comma. Then that gets that concept, gives notice.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. The amount, Mr. Gruskin, I was confused. I think it's because I wasn't thinking something through. The $50, the $25 tax on professional lobbyists, I guess I'm getting tired and the day is getting longer. I thought that would be for those who are under existing law. were required to register as professional lobbyists, but which I didn't think covered somebody who does not lobby at the state government level. Is that wrong?
The way Title 29 defines professional lobbyists, it is a restricted lobbying at the state level.
Oh, and where is that? I'm sorry, I overlooked that.
Paragraph 5 of Section 2 means any individual who engages himself or herself or is engaged by any other person for pay or for any consideration for lobbying.
So who will collect that tax?
The Department of Revenue.
So then, so everyone will then report to the Department of Revenue. Okay. Sorry, I just hadn't thought that through.
So the, I guess I need it. So the 600 is probably grossly understated.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's grossly understated. It's certainly understated because, I mean, as I said, we can all think of people who lobby or, who are professional lobbyists at the local level. But I don't think it's based on anecdotal stuff totally, I don't think it's a doubling of the number, but I don't know exactly what it is. And I don't think there's probably any way to discern that.
Do we know, is there a consensus whether municipalities all require registration for lobbyists?
I don't know if all, I mean, certainly major municipalities do. But
I don't know, and I would guess that there's not a lot of lobbyists that are professional lobbyists only at the local level. I may be wrong. I'm sure it happens, but I'm just not aware of any large body of professional lobbyists that are not registered at the state government level.
Maria Garcia Berry? Not registered at state level.
No, but I'm just saying, I mean, there are. But, and I guess a related issue is what, to the extent that, say, a city like Denver hires somebody to lobby at the federal level, I mean, and somebody either locally or in Washington, D.C., would they be subject to the Colorado tax on professional lobbyists?
Well, they're not subject to the jurisdiction of the Independent Ethics Commission because...
But are they doing business in Colorado and therefore subject to a Colorado occupation tax?
Well, but the question would be whether or not they lobby the people mentioned in Article 29, which are government employees, local government employees, local government officials, members of the General Assembly, public officials, public officers. And those are all specific as to jurisdiction, state jurisdiction, local jurisdiction.
Okay. Well, do you have a are you okay with the number that we have at this point? Anybody want? We have tentatively filled in $14,825. I don't know. I don't think we've actually adopted that yet. Any feeling about whether that should be increased?
Can I ask, why did you divide that by two?
I did because it was based on a $50 fee, when in fact the measure now provides a $25 fee. But then it's still, I mean, based on the discussion, it probably understates it. The $14,825 probably understates the actual revenue from the tax because it's not just those. It shouldn't be based just on those that register with the Secretary of State. But
well, we're all conceding it's not an accurate number, right?
Well, I mean, estimates are always just that, estimates. But just like this morning, production fee, the proponent didn't feel that the OSPB estimate necessarily included the impact of the inclusion of the value of land being imposed under the measure. We increased the amount of the estimate, and we could do that, I mean, in terms of, you know, whether it's 20,000, 25,000, in terms of if Mr. Gruskin wants a cushion of some sort, do that.
Has the Supreme Court spoken to estimating it all?
I don't think so.
How about 20,000?
Sounds like an auction. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, you did address this on the tobacco tax, because there was dispute over whether there would be such a decrease in demand that it would somehow affect the tax. And you did. You rounded up, as I recall, anyway. You rounded up to some extent, feeling like you couldn't project what the market would be, just as you can't project whether or not people drop out of the profession or, mm-hmm. you know, decide to become caretakers or gardeners instead of professional lobbyists sometimes in the summer. So, you know, $20,000 is, I think, fine. And then if it doesn't raise quite that much, that's just a ceiling.
Yeah, it's just a ceiling. I don't think that.
I'll move $20,000.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded.
Can I have 1 second? Yeah, I'm trying to read this provision about, I'm not sure this is applicable, saying that in Tabor, except by later voter approval, if a tax increase or fiscal year spending exceeds any estimate in B3, which is the notice that has to be mailed out, explaining the first full year fiscal year increase, the tax increase is thereafter reduced up to 100% in proportion to the combined dollar excess and the combined excess revenue refunded in the next fiscal year. So if you collect more than you estimated, you have to refund it or reduce the next year revenues. Is that right? Based on what you estimate. So I think it's, if you're okay with 20,000.
20,000 would represent that would suggest that there are at least 200 local lobbyists. That appears to be, from what I know, a fair estimate.
So that would be an additional 5,000 added on to the 14,825. So we're still in the ballpark. So
we moved and seconded.
Okay.
Is that where we're at?
Yep. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Let's read. I'll read into the record this, the staff draft as amended. State taxes shall be increased $20,000 annually by an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the implementation of state constitutional provisions imposing standards of conduct by persons involved with governmental activities, in connection therewith, imposing an occupational tax on professional lobbyists in the initial amount of $25 in words annually to supplement monies in the state's general fund expended to support the Independent Ethics Commission, permitting the General Assembly, without future voter approval, to increase or decrease the occupational tax so long as revenues from the tax do not annually exceed 90% of general fund expenditures for the commission for the fiscal year in which the tax is to be paid, semicolon, excluding the revenues raised by the tax from any existing restrictions on spending, comma, revenues, comma, or appropriations, semicolon, clarifying that the existing constitutional provisions ban the solicitation, comma, acceptance, comma, or receipt of gifts or things of value by a public officer, comma, member of the General Assembly, comma, local government official, comma, or government employee if doing so constitutes a breach of the public trust for private gain, semicolon, and reenacting specified provisions of Article 29 of the State Constitution, comma, as clarified by this measure, comma, if the provisions are invalidated by a court before this measure is approved, period. Is there a motion to adopt the staff draft as amended?
I'll second that. Any further discussion?
If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. I think that concludes action on number 21. The time is 4:46. Thank you. We will, since this is the last title board meeting for measures that may be on the November 2007 ballot, any motions for rehearing that are filed within the 7-day period must be heard within 48 hours after the expiration of the 7-day period. I'd suggest that we, if we do get motions for rehearing, that they be heard Thursday, the 24th at 1 o'clock, subject to finding a place to meet. But tentatively, I'd suggest May 24th at 1 o'clock. But we'll clarify that or we'll provide formal notice if at a later date. That concludes our agenda.